I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Barry Carbon, AM. Welcome, Barry.
Pleased to be here.
Well, here we are in the centre of the Fremantle, really, on the West End, in the old Customs House, not far from the port, not far from probably where you went to school many years ago. Where did you grow up, Barry?
Grew up in South Fremantle initially, born during the war, when dads were away doing other things. So, like lots of people, we lived with grandparents. My grandfather had been a 10-pound pom, had worked on the railways and then semi-retired and got a job as assistant gardener at the town of Fremantle. And his job was to plant Norfolk Island pines. And he's got some monuments to him all around the place now. They're all over, just over 100 years now.
Well, I hadn't realised there was going to be such a direct link to your later career, Barry, in environmental science, working for Alcoa and all sorts of things that we'll come to where trees are involved one way or the other.
Yeah, the trees then, that he told me, because he used to take me for walks most mornings and say, "These are my trees, son." And these trees were planted because it was thought that they might grow up to be good masts for sailing ships.
Which was why in Governor Phillips' days in Sydney, they, just about as soon as they arrived, sent a ship off to Norfolk Island to bring such masts in.
Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So his name was Harrison, and his boss was Harris. So the town gardener was Harris, and he was the assistant gardener, his name was Harrison.
Probably thought he was his son.
So all the way from the port, and the Esplanade was reclaimed land then, all the way down there through South Fremantle, there were pine trees planted. And I can tell you with confidence, most of them are between 100 and 110 years old.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yep.
And what are your earliest memories? What sort of ages are you in South Fremantle?
I can remember at the age of two, my mother walking me to the Fremantle Town Hall at evening to celebrate the end of the Second World War. All I can remember about it was people standing around, mainly women, standing around in a circle blowing trumpets and making lots of noise. And I remember then walking home with her to South Fremantle, half walking, half being pushed in a little pusher. That's my first memory. When South Fremantle really was a workers' area. Most of the people there had jobs on the railways or in the port. And it was a community area, which I appreciated then and still do.
Is it right to use the expression working class for the people who lived in South Fremantle in those days? Or was that not an expression that we ever used?
No, they all thought they're pretty well off, okay? Now, and these things are all relative. One of my memories is about the propos. And I'll tell you the propo story.
How do you spell propos?
Oh, you don't spell it, you just say propo, propo. And the Second World War finished and soldiers came back. Now, my father was an enlisted soldier, so he was a bit later back than the rest of them. But they came back and they were given privileges. One of my father's friends, a Bill Dermer, was given a university education. He went off and became a dentist well known around Fremantle. Other friends of his took conditional purchase land and went off and were farmers. He was married, which some of them weren't, and had a child, me, and he wanted a job. Now he was given preferential treatment for employment as a wharfie. Being a wharfie was considered a well-paid, secure job in those days, and he took that job. And he and my parents used to tell me about the people that missed out. They're Aborigines, when all the rest of them were given these things. The few Aborigines that he was in the army with went and lived in the caves in Coogee because they were non-people. They couldn't vote, they didn't have any rights, they didn't get anything. And Dad said he'd trained all through the army years with a guy that he called Krakua, which today we call Cracker, and his sons became champion footballers for Claremont and then in Victoria. And they used to walk through the streets of South Fremantle with large sticks over their shoulders with a wire at the top which you used to prop up your clothesline. And they'd call propo, propo, and in the right season you'd go out and the propo would also have crayfish in a bag which they'd caught off the reefs. So I never asked the question, how you spell propo? It was just something that was called out.
Well, in a sense, more things change, more they stay the same. We, before too long, going to be asked to vote at a referendum on the voice for Indigenous people in this country. It rather goes back to the issues you've just been talking about, Barry. Fremantle more broadly, stepping out of South Fremantle and coming back into the sort of the heart of Fremantle,
yep.
Town hall included. What are your memories of that as you were sort of growing up?
A lot of it was wharf based. You might find this hard to believe, but I talked a lot when I was young. I used to drive my mother nuts. So my father used to take me to work with him on the wharf, which meant he'd take me down there and then leave me with some fishing lines. And from the age of about five onwards, I'd go fishing up and down the wharf. And I was exposed to all sorts of people with all sorts of nicknames on the wharf, most of whom had very, very limited education because they'd grown up in the Great Depression, but a whole lot of intelligent, caring, worthwhile human beings who were a really important part of my education, I think. I also remember the places in Fremantle which then population respected. They respected the what they called the Jewish church right next door to Fremantle Oval, because they said that was the first church that they remembered in Fremantle. And they were it was important to them that was looked after. And this was in a day when you still had quite strong differentiation in views between Protestants and Catholics and Jews. But that was the first church they needed to look after. The other thing that was important to them was St. John's Church and the Fremantle Town Hall. Because the story is that the St. John's Church had been shifted from the location which is now the Fremantle Town Hall, because Fremantle wanted to use that location for its town hall. And when it shifted St. John's Church, it also put in there a whole lot of stained glass windows which had come from Yorkshire. The people of Yorkshire had got together and made these donations. And as my grandfather had come from Yorkshire, from Ull, he used to say, I come from Ariaris and I come from Ull. Those windows were important to them, as was the town hall. The town hall, of course, was built by a tax on beer. When people in the mining eras had paid a penny a drink for a tax on beer to build the town hall.
So where did you go to primary school?
I tried to go to primary school at Beaconsfield, and they said, no, there's too many kids and there's not enough schools been built since the war and the Depression, and unless you're born in the first half of the year, you can't come to Beaconsfield. So my parents thought, we can't have this noisy little kid around the house. We're going to go and buy a house in East Fremantle, which they put a deposit on and signed it off, and they were then gazumped. In those days, gazumping was legal. And they then bought a block of land in Birdwood Circus, Bicton, and in 12 weeks had a house built on it.
Oh my God.
And And in those days, there was quite a bit of labour available, people coming out of the war, but there was things were still rationed. I mean, sugar and butter were rationed, for example, so were bricks. And so my father had to use all sorts of mechanisms to get enough bricks to build a house, which he built there. And my mother then proudly took me up to Richmond Primary School for the first day of school, and they said, "No, he's too young. You've got to be born in the first half." She said, "Well, I can't stand this." We walked straight from there to Bicton Primary, where I went. To Bicton, as did my five brothers and sisters, younger brothers and sisters.
They lacked discrimination.
That's right. That was age discrimination.
And where did you go to high school?
Went to high school at Fremantle Boys for the first one and a bit terms, and that then became John Curtin. So I and my friends were the first class to do 5 years at John Curtin High School. And we were particularly privileged. We were an experimental class where people were chosen on some sort of scholarship basis to go and study three sciences and two maths, which was pretty unusual in those days. And we got a very privileged education.
Barry, jumping forward just a little bit, I first met you, I think, when you were the chair of the EPA, the WA Environmental Protection Authority. You were there for many years. You then were the head of the Commonwealth's EPA, then Queensland's,
yes,
then New Zealand's.
Yep.
But when you finished school, you went into science, and you finished up working for CSIRO, CSIRO as we often call it. How did all that come about?
I had no idea what I wanted to do for a living when I was at high school. Probably still don't. I won some sort of a competition at high school to get employed as a cadet engineer at the BHP steel rolling mill.
At Kwinana.
At Kwinana, brand new building. I was out of, I don't know, several hundred kids. I'd won this competition to be employed, and they sacked me after about 6 weeks.
Why?
Well, the steel rolling mill had been set up at Kwinana at the behest of the Premier Sir Charles Court. He said to BHP, if you're going to take the iron ore from the state, you've got to do some secondary processing here. And BHP didn't like that. So they set up the steel rolling mill when it would have been much cheaper for them to do the whole lot in Eastern Australia. But they didn't spend much money on maintenance on it. And I arrived there and was by lovely people showing me the ropes around the place. And in this very hot place, none of the fans worked because they wouldn't spend any money on maintenance. And there were people getting injured in accidents through molten steel going over them. And the control tower, which was 50 degrees centigrade, people were passing out in, and they had this young trainee driving the thing, and there was a major accident, and people went and complained to the managers and got sacked on the spot. So this kid in the control tower turned off the rolling mill, me. And they didn't like that, and we parted ways. So that was the end of my engineering career.
The end of your engineering career, but yeah, the start of something else.
Well, then I got a job advertised at CSIRO as a technical assistant, and part of the attraction of a technical assistant is you could do part-time studies, which I did. In fact, I did part-time studies for 12 years and ended up with all sorts of bits of paper. CSIRO was very good to me.
It was, and still is in many ways, reduced in some ways from the intense position it once held. But when I was a kid, we had to learn all of these abbreviations.
Yes.
UNESCO and
yep.
WHO
yep.
and
yep.
CSIRO and yep, all of these
right.
things.
Yep,
I mean, it was such an important organisation.
Well, it was, and it had been set up to assist Australians. And in fact, the motto was Science for Society. But somewhere along the track, it became without any motto science for sale. So effectively, if you want some really high class science done, you hire CSIRO, and the government pays us part of that, and CSIRO's changed, as indeed all of society has. But it was a really important part of the agricultural revolution in Australia. It was an important part of the early industrial revolutions in Australia. But organisations change, times change.
They do, and that was very much part of that post-Second World War reconstruction phase.
Correct, yes.
And the research you were doing at that point, essentially, what was it?
I started off doing agricultural research. And then it became pretty obvious to me that there were things about our environment which we had very little basic science on. We didn't understand how our native forests worked. We didn't understand how our wetlands worked. We didn't even have a really good understanding of our water relations on sandy soils. I mean, urban Western Australia is the world capital of sand, and most of the knowledge about water relations that comes from soils that are either loamy or got clay in them. And there's a whole lot of science about our place that we didn't know. So that was what I focused on.
Grandad Harrison knew that a Norfolk pine would grow in this sandy, limey, limestoney soil.
He certainly did. He certainly did. And it really was a pretty exciting time because things were happening and changing as a consequence of we people being here. Our water supplies were becoming affected and our soils become affected by salt because we had changed the landscape. Okay, there were diseases affecting our forests like Jarrah dieback, which is much wider than just Jarrah. There were insects like the insects that wipe out all the chewits in Chewit Hill are gone and all the white gums in White Gum Valley are gone. They're all from insects. So all of these environmental issues were there ripe for study.
Speaking of the white gums of White Gum Valley, what species of tree were the
white chewit.
I always thought they were chewit. Somebody suggested wandu, but I don't think wandu would be down here.
No, wandu is a particularly fussy tree. Wandu grows in the Jarrah forest areas in the uplands where there is quite shallow, dry soil. And it's a very tough, very slow-growing tree. I think a beautiful tree.
Absolutely beautiful.
There are a couple of different wandus and they're lovely. But the chewits, which they named Chewit Hill after, were famous there. They were famous in Bold Park. One of the first agricultural publications in this state was called What's Killing the Chewits in Bold Park. All right, so, but then the chewits were known as white gums because they change colour in seasons and they're quite white in
and you only
some
have to
seasons.
Cut a branch in half and have a look at it.
Yeah, yeah. And so White Gum Valley is all chewits was.
Now you spent what, 15 odd years at CSIRO?
17 years at CSIRO.
17. And then you got what must have seemed to many of your friends as a plum job at the Environmental Protection Authority.
No. In between that, there was I got a job for 5 years running environmental affairs for Alcoa.
Aha.
So I had been studying the impact of bauxite mining on the Jarrah Forest and all the surrounds. And they came to me and said, we'd like you to come to work for us. And I laughed at them, actually. I said, oh, come on, you're kidding me. You're the bad guys. And they said, well, here's the offer. Unlimited staff, unlimited budget, no control of what you say, no control of what you do, but be aware that we are, and we do monthly surveys on this, they said, we are the most hated company in Australia. We want to be outside of the most hated company of Australia, outside the top 10 in the first year, and outside the top 20 within 5 years. And I thought, that's a pretty good offer. So I took the job.
And You wouldn't recount all of those objectives that the company had unless you were able to secure a number of them, Barry. How did you go?
Well, I was very lucky because we had these. There was a good foundation and there was a very good staff, and the company was quite concerned that their lease, which was a very generous lease, could be taken away from them. So we really invented modern rehabilitation. It's recognised all over the world. There are global awards as the best rehabilitation, mining rehabilitation in the world. We opened it up totally to full public scrutiny and disclosure. And if you're going to have bauxite mining in the only Jarrah forest in the world, I believe the least you can do is do some pretty damn good rehabilitation.
There's also a period when conservation-minded people, Southwest Forest Defence Foundation, for example, wanted to see no logging in old-growth forests. They weren't happy with what Alcoa was doing.
Yep.
How did you find yourself, both as a scientist and perhaps emotionally, dealing with all of that changing society at that point?
I'm fairly open that I don't have a problem with development. I never have had. And I accept that there's some development I'd rather not have. I'd rather not have the Jarrah Forest mined. But if you're going to do it, and society's made that decision, you damn well should do it as well as you can. And I was pretty comfortable with that. And I was pretty comfortable with working with the conservation community, who didn't like me very much at that stage, and say, what are your big issues? Well, the biggest issue was that there were no conservation areas in any forest in Western Australia. Full stop, none. Okay. They said, we are worried that you'll go to the best forest areas and you'll mine them. And we don't like that. So with the agreement of the Pittsburgh board, and I've got to give them credit, we went with the scientists around the place and picked out the best forest areas and said, we won't mine them provided you, the state, agree that you're not going to log them or no one else is going to mine them. And we had great resistance from the foresters of the day. They said, no, we believe in ongoing continuous logging. We fought that fight and won. And so the first ever forest conservation areas in the state were done directly as a consequence of Alcoa blackmailing the state. I have no doubt about it. And they, Alcoa, knew that as long as someone could legitimately say, you're going to mine the best bits, they were vulnerable.
So you're at Alcoa, and I jumped into it quickly, knowing that but forgetting that. But also, we're in a period when the environmental protection legislation in the world probably needs upgrading, does it?
It did. The first lots of environmental protection legislation, and West Australia was very early, actually, in the 1970s, followed up USA and then the federal one, and then Western Australia. So they're pretty early. They were really pollution control regulations and had very little power for the Environment Minister. So the bit about redoing environmental legislation in Western Australia was being looked at while I was at Alcoa. And while I was at Alcoa, I also became chair of the Chamber of Mines Environment Committee, so I led all the mining input to the change in legislation, and had a lot of say in where I thought it should go.
So 1986 sees the passage of the new Environmental Protection Act, and
yep.
Introduces environmental impact assessment.
Correct.
In a more direct and comprehensive
more direct
way.
And powerful way. Yeah.
And about the same time, is it? You become.
I became chair in 85, but having done all the work towards it, and I guess one of the reasons that the government appointed me to that position was they were adamant that they wanted to have a model which protected the environment but allowed development. They wanted to have both, not one or the other. And with people from the department, Rob Sepe particularly, and people who were appointed to the EPA with me, Peter Johnston and John Bailey particularly, we did a lot of work towards developing an Environmental Protection Act, which was lauded around the world as one which had environmental objectives rather than control objectives. There's a very big difference, Michael, in having a model which gives you control versus a model which gives you an output. And this was a model that was based on giving outputs, which it delivered on. All right, it's been tinkered with, chewed around, abdicated to over the years, and it's now much more of a control-based one, as indeed it is environmental control. But in those days, it gave us all sorts of power to do all sorts of things which needed doing.
I imagine holding a position like that, chair of the EPA, Barry, would be a bit like being a football umpire, that you sort of probably not making anyone happy. The fans on one side, if you're a football umpire, don't like the free kick, the other one's prepared to cheer it, you walk off, you probably get an empty can of beer thrown at you. You were a football umpire, Barry, for a while.
I was. That happened...
Younger.
Much younger. I like most kids growing up in Fremantle, I was going to be a champion something or other. I was going to be a champion footballer, despite the fact that I was a runt and I could be easily pushed around. And was easily injured. I was going to be, in my mind, a champion, but it didn't turn out that way. So when at 17 and a half I snapped a cruciate ligament, that was the end of any football aspirations. I took to umpiring as a way to build up a leg which had been patched up with wires and screws, and it lasted a long time. It was we didn't have a lot of money. It was a bit of a side job, and I found it like spending time on the wharf with my father. I found it a great interaction with ordinary people, which I think is the university of the world.
Did you enjoy running out onto the ground and hearing
it.
The boos?
Oh yeah. I never worried about the boos. In fact, there were couple of things that got up my nose, but there were a lot. Most of them were quite funny. I can recall umpiring a game at East Fremantle one day, and it was drizzling rain. It was a very pleasant day, and as I walked off, those days you should walk between the crowd walking off, and you'd have the boundary umpires behind you, and there was, I can say it now, it was a little old lady. She must have been about what I am now, you know, late 70s, I guess, and she came up to me and said, You, and then he slapped me backhand across the face. Didn't hurt. And she turned around to her husband and said, "See, I told you I was going to hit him." So,
was it a derby or was it?
No. But it was an East Fremantle game. I remember the East Fremantle games because my father-in-law barracked for East Fremantle. He used to think I hated East Fremantle, so he used to stand there and boo me.
He kept a count of the free kicks against
him. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
who were the best few, as many as you like, WAFL players in those days that you saw running around when you umpired?
Oh, many of them. Polly Farmer. Polly was a wonderful footballer. Had a wonderful football brain, and was the best swearer I ever heard on the football
really?
Field. When Polly was coaching West Perth, and he was talking to his players, the grass used to die in a circle round him from what he was calling them.
But Norm Smith had nothing on him.
He was a something else footballer. Barry Cable. Yeah. Cable could be injured and still acquire 30 possessions a day and dispose of them brilliantly. Some players had that knack of getting the ball, and he was great. Keith Donkin. Mel Winnan, Bill Dempsey, I umpired some of the early days of John Jerovich and John Todd. They were great footballers.
Well, that must have steeled you, as I'm suggesting, for your public service days, dealing with battles between conservationists and developers and government regulators who want it both ways. What were the big issues on the WAEPA in that period?
Well, the first issue for me was that I only took the job on the basis that I ran both the EPA and the department, because I was adamant that you either had an objective-driven system, which was the EPA, or you had a control-based system. You couldn't have both. It would just stifle everything, which had been what was happening, and we weren't going anywhere. So the objective was to have good quality development that in an open and transparent way gave people the environment they wanted. For example, you couldn't drive through Kwinana without being stunk out. You could even smell it in Fremantle. You needed to fix up Kwinana not only for its odour but for the imposed risk that it put on society, and we cleaned all that up. The Kalgoorlie mines had been developed on the basis of shafts being down following the gold, but that had largely petered out and been replaced by halo mining all the areas around. And the halo mining needed to be roasted, and you couldn't roast that in town without killing everyone with sulfur dioxide concentrations. So we actually took control of the sulfur dioxide emissions, shifted all the roasters, and so Kalgoorlie was still going at 100 miles an hour, though it would have been stopped. We had no marine parks in Western Australia, so we got the first marine park at Hillary's, which was an offshoot from the America's Cup. The America's Cup was coming to Western Australia, and it was inevitable that the Swan River was to be turned into a parking area for boats. So with the then government, we got the Hillary's Boat Harbour built, all the design that went into that. We had a long-running issue with Peel Inlet, which was totally polluted. You couldn't live along there, you couldn't visit there. It wasn't suitable for people or for wildlife. Cleaning that up was a really important thing.
Well, this is the Peel Inlet before we had a cut in it.
Well, the cut was a direct consequence of EPA recommendations. All the science said that you had to do something about it or it was to be ruined, and the cut was a recommendation to government that was initially to cost $70 million, and it may or may not work. There were a lot of doubting people that said this won't work, and it has. All right? And it's a large compliment to the scientists and the engineers of the time, all public servants, who were good at what they do, lousy at blowing their own trumpet, okay? But the thousands of people that go to the Peel area and Mandurah now can thank those scientists for what's been done. And the courage of the government, by the way. It takes a lot of guts for a government to commit $70 million to a project where some people are saying, no, that's not going to work.
And that's in the money of those days.
In the money of those days, it was a lot of... That was just marginally less than it cost to build Fremantle Harbour.
Well, you've written a lovely little book called Saving the Peel Estuary, a Public Service.
About trying to give some credit to the public servants who did that job.
As I've intimated, following your time in the WAEPA, you went to the Commonwealth for a number of years, Queensland for a number of years, New Zealand for a number of years. In a broad sense, does the stripe, the colour, the persuasion of a government matter a lot in this whole area of environmental regulation? And of course today we live in a world of climate change much more explicitly.
I think that the outstanding thing to me about all those government jobs, but I need to qualify first of all, I spent too long in Western Australia. If you're going to do a job like running the EPA and the department properly, you build up scar tissue. All right? And if you're going to do it properly, you should do it for a limited time. So all those other jobs I took with a limit of 5 years, which I did. All right? But it was surprising to me the similarity of job description that each government gave me. And in each case, the most senior people in government gave me a job description that said, we want the environment to be done properly, but we want people to be rewarded for human endeavour, and we want both. So we don't want just the environment, and we don't want carte blanche for development. We expect systems that deliver both. And right through from Minister Roz Kelly, who in my opinion was an outstanding minister despite the way she was dealt with politically, Peter Beattie in Queensland, and then Helen Clark Helen Clark called me into her office the day I was appointed and said...
She was the PM.
She said, congratulations on your job. We've been doing it very badly in New Zealand. Our environment sucks and our developers hate it. And you've got a year to fix it up or I'm going to do something about it. Thank you, Barry. See you later.
Well, I love a decisive politician.
Well, can I tell you, nobody who's ever met Helen Clark could say she's anything other than decisive. Yeah.
So, coming back to that broad question of mine, it sounds like you're intimating that the politicians can really matter in this area of the environment. They can provide the direction and a clear encouragement for certain outcomes.
Well, I think they could more than they can now. I think that the world has turned against politicians since the age of properness has come upon us. For example, it's not possible in most Australian states for developers to go and talk to a minister. That's not allowed. It's got to be done.
Well, in New South Wales, they can't make political donations.
Yeah, that's
probably
right.
Probably turn out to be the same everywhere before long.
Yeah, that's right. But certainly there is guidance given to the value system. And I actually think the most important thing a political system can deliver to society is a value system. Before policies, before actions, the thing that sits up the top is a value system.
And what are some of the components of that?
Well, for me, the value system I've always insisted on was total openness and honesty, all right? Total. And that means you don't have a 100-page report when you can do it in two because the public's got to be able to read it. That means that everything you do is made public. And I've gone a whole career with only one thing that wasn't made public, and that was the formula for making artificial gems, all right? That's everything else has gone public. It's the principles that Peter Johnson taught me. You listen to the community, you take on board what they say and you respond to them. You give fair process to everybody and never use the process to punish people. And it's very easy for public servants to use process to punish people, to manipulate things. Never do any of those things. And in my opinion, if you're particularly open, people will accept things they don't necessarily like. They'll accept them, and they will give significant power. So that's carried me through a whole. One of the things that surprised me is just how powerful I felt in each of those positions. Taking the power of the community, and then how the person that comes after me was totally disinterested in that and has gone back to processes rather than outcomes. And so it's very hard to think, maybe I was the only one in step there. And if you look at modern environmental protection, I think it's got some screamingly obvious things it needs to do.
Like what?
And it's not, well, The bit about environmental impact assessment, which I was fortunate enough to be on the wave of its effectiveness, is no longer sufficient to protect some of the values we want. It is no good just running faster and harder at a system that's not working. We are losing major species, right? And we need to, instead of saying, oh, we're going to reduce the amount we clear, we're going to reduce the amount we emit, that is no longer good enough. And it takes a positive action by human beings that cause these changes. I mean, our grandkids will hate us if there's no more woylies or numbats or wombats in
black
our
cockatoos.
System. And this bit about well, we're going to have a system that's more powerful at stopping things, it's so obviously failing. And yet people think they're going to get there because they're going to run harder and faster.
So this comes back to what you said much earlier, that you took the WA EPA job because you were focused on outcomes.
Yes.
Not just regulatory process.
Correct.
Hoping the outcomes came with it.
Yes.
And that's really what you're promoting now. People have to focus on what it is they're actually trying to achieve.
Correct.
Can I ask you about, I've mentioned it, and it's something that's taken front and centre over the years that you've been doing the jobs you've been doing, and that is climate change,
yes.
Net zero. Do you have views about how that's to be achieved when it comes to an outcome-based approach?
Yes, I have strong views about it. The first, and this is a political statement, the first view is that the emissions in Australia are the Commonwealth's responsibility. I actually don't think the states have got power. They've got an obligation under social obligations, but all the power, I think, belongs to the Commonwealth. They've written all the international conventions, and I'm not sure that CO2 emissions come under the state powers anyway, although they use them. But I think there is no doubt in my mind that the way to control major emitters in Australia is to have a system that requires the major emitters to step back step by step by step. And whether you do it by a carbon tax, which I thought was a good idea, or by targets, then cutting emissions is the way that'll go. But the really tough thing with climate change is not only the Australian politics, the tough thing is that we can't stop the bloody thing. I mean, what we've done already has locked in changes which will cause the world to go backwards for 100 years. 100 years, if we're optimistic. And it's a really hard sell to say to society, hey, we've got to be better than what we are because we want 100 years' time to be better than what it is. But that's what the real sell is. All right? So I've always thought that the world in its own clumsy way will come to reducing emissions, and it's been clumsier than I thought it would be. We're actually still getting worse globally than getting better, but we will make that come. But the reality is we've already locked in changes that will go for 100 years, and I think that it's really critical that we get past this nonsense argument about, well, it's not real, it's only natural perturbations, blah, blah, blah. We get past those nonsense arguments and say, how is the world going to respond? In my humble opinion, there are two really big things for Australia. We've got to look at what wildlife we're going to save, numbats, wombats, black cockatoos, those sort of things, and take proactive action to save them. And we've got to say, what can we do in our global role for those people who aren't going to come out the other side of this? And I'm looking mainly at the Pacific Islanders, but they're not going to come out of this. The reality is the number of storms that are going to hit them at high intensity are going to take away all their water supply, the first thing, and then it's going to take away their land. But water supply is enough to get rid of them, and Australia's got to start having some grown-up discussions with New Zealand about taking Pacificas into our country. They're my big questions for climate change. The other stuff I think is shrapnel about how we're going to reduce stuff and all that. You know, electric vehicles are coming. Do you know 1/3 of the vehicles sold in China next year are going to be electric? That that argument is over. It's now so much cheaper to produce electricity in Australia through renewable than from coal. Why in the hell would anyone be contemplating building another coal-fired power station? And I don't think we will anymore. I think we've grown up past that stage.
Barry, let me say, tongue-in-cheek, you in particular, but me not far behind, have all got older. And that old saying, which didn't mean so much to me 20 years ago even, that we worry about all of these environmental things for our grandchildren, actually becomes to really mean something now.
Absolutely.
How do you see Australia in 40 years' time even?
Well, I think that's one of our big questions. I think we've got to take the big jump to intrusive management of the environment. And some parts of our society are. You've got voluntary nature conservation things out there, putting fences around the area and killing off cats and keeping them, and foxes, and keeping them pristine. Well, the grown-ups in government should be doing that sort of thing. We should not be encouraging black cockatoos into the city, because the poor buggers get killed by cars. But just on the periphery of the city, because we've taken away all their natural environment, we're about to take away all the pine trees that they live on now, we've got to start providing them alternate food. The same way that if you're going to keep koalas in southern Queensland, you've got to start growing things specifically to feed them, and you've got to start feeding them. But if just saying, oh, we're going to protect what's there, it's not working. It's not going to work. So intrusive, targeted activity, otherwise these things will be lost. And
are you optimistic or are you pessimist?
Oh, I'm always optimistic that people will get the message, but I think that I'm less optimistic about the leadership that comes from politicians than what I used to be, because I think politicians have been captured by a wave of properness. That means that a lot of the decisions are made by middle-level people within the system, and the middle-level people, quite understandably, follow what's important to them. I mean, if what's important to them is noise pollution, they'll put in very complicated things on noise emissions, or if what's important to them is saving some particular variety of frog, they'll look after that. The trying to do everything to a mediocre level is failing and will fail. And I'm optimistic that the governments will find a way to provide leadership over that.
So it comes down to leadership?
Yes.
If you were the PM or the Premier for a period, what would be your approach? Do you have to have a big vision and confidence to achieve it?
Well, I strongly believe that leaders get their power to do things from the community. And so you need to have people who are prepared to take the community with them. And that means leadership from within or without. And I guess, Michael, you and I are now at the stage where we have not sufficient influence to make things happen. You just got to hope the next generation is going to do that.
Well, I have every confidence in all the wonderful young people who come behind us. But I guess we'll have a few years to watch, Barry.
I hope so.
It's been really lovely talking to you. Thanks for
meeting me. It's been lovely talking with you, Michael.